everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the new age of transhumanism and the future deconstruction of the human being. My guest from Spain is Daniel Eschelin. Daniel is a top investigative journalist. He is an independent researcher. He's actually infiltrated the agendas and conversations conducted at the infamous Bilderberg meetings. He has a background in military intelligence, and he's been researching the history and ongoing activities of the Bilderberg Group and organizations that have taken upon themselves to dictate how we should be living, what our future should be. We didn't elect them to that, but they've decided to make it their own. Daniel's recent book is called Transevolution, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction, which lays out a future map where humanity is heading within the rush to create a trans or post-human. He has also written the bestsellers The True Story of the Bilderberg Group and Shadow Masters. And he is also on the World Wide Web at danieleschelin.com. Nice to have you with us today, Daniel.
It's great to be on your show. Thank you so much again for the invitation.
Daniel, when you were on our Daily Noon broadcast earlier, we were just starting to get into the subject of transhumanism. And for the benefit of listeners who didn't hear that program, I'll just restate that most people are unfamiliar with the term transhumanism and the technologies and mission associated with it. The major media is mute about it. However, we increasingly see images of a transhumanistic future in movies and even cartoons, and it's a movement progressing rapidly in segments of the scientific community and in university labs, and I'm quite sure in secret labs that no one outside of those working there know about. Government, military agencies, scientific and medical associations, and private corporations are investing massive funds to radically alter the human body, the mind, and the entire human experience into something other than what we have normally considered naturally human since the dawn of humankind. Now, there are several dimensions to transhumanism. There are biological, evolutionary, neurological, technological, and even metaphysical ways to look at it, and I hope we'll be able to explore for this hour each of these more deeply. And I'd like to backtrack a bit and ask you to start by explaining what transhumanism is, and identify and explain some of its primary characteristics, and also how it's being sold. And just one last caveat.
Transhumanism is
an
ultra-high-tech dream of computer scientists and philosophers and neuroscientists and people in many different fields, such as futurists. And what they do is they seek to use radical advances in technology to augment the human body, the human mind, and ultimately the entire human experience. Transhumanists wish to become what they call post-human. And post-human is someone who has been modified with performance-enhancing body and brain augmentations to the point that they could no longer call themselves human. They have literally mutated themselves into an altogether new being. And now to most people, Gary, this sounds like something from a science fiction film. However, few people are aware of incredible breakthroughs in technology, which makes the whole transhumanist vision a very real possibility for the near future. Some of the people who are involved in the transhumanist movement are, you know, world famous scientists and investigators, and, you know, people like Ray Kurzweil, the poster boy for the whole transhumanist movement. He is the, you know, tech director for Google. Ishikawa, the theoretical physicist. Jason Silver, a futurist. And again, the idea is that one of the areas of the transhumanist vision for the near future, for example, is neurochip interfaces, which are computer chips connect directly to the brain, and that's being developed right now. And the ultimate goal of a brain chip from a transhumanist point of view will be to increase intelligence thousands, if not millions of times over, basically turning the human brain into the supercomputer. There's other elements, you know, which are metaphysical elements, which are very important also to understand. For example, lifelong emotional well-being is a key concept within the transhumanist movement, and they are convinced that you can achieve this through a recalibration of the pleasure centers in the brain. Pharmaceutical mood renders have been suggested, which will be cleaner and safer than the mind-altering drugs that we saw, you know, back in the 1960s. And this nightmare vision is Aldous Huxley's 21st century scientific dictatorship without tears. And, you know, using this type of technology could dramatically, on the one hand, prolong lifespan, which is an amazing thing. The Global Futures 2045 International Congress predicted that by 2045, that's in one generation, Gary, it will be possible to live forever by combining technology and biology into an event they call singularity. And the singularity would occur at a point in which artificial intelligence surpasses the capabilities of the human brain. So from cyborgs with very long lifespans to downloading consciousness itself into a machine, transhumanists say that it is impossible to predict exactly what the post-human will be, but that it will be better. And, you know, the whole point of, the cornerstone, using Masonic terminology, of my book, Transevolution, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction, is what I'm saying is that we, as the human race, are standing at the cusp of the greatest evolutionary change in the history of mankind. And what is coming in the next very, 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 very few years will completely redefine the very definition of humanity. And again, as a result of these incredible technological advancements, we are standing and looking at something which we have absolutely no idea what it will turn itself into. And just to finish off, the whole idea of transhumanism was born out of humanism, which is yet another clever disguise of scientism created specifically so that global eugenics operations could be carried out by the globalists without being noticed.
Let's take this apart piece by piece to better understand it. First, from the optimist, if you have a loved one or you yourself have, let's say, an aging brain, or maybe you have defects in the neurons. Maybe you have an amyloid plaque laid down. So you're suffering from dementia, Alzheimer's, maybe Parkinson. Maybe you have a defect in your kidneys or liver, and you're not going to be able to have a quality of life. If someone said, all right, we have now invented a way of creating some stem cells that can go in there and actually rejuvenate the diseased tissue, eliminate it from the body, and rebuild the existing tissue, then people are going to herald that. And the initial people who do that will be regarded as significant to the field of health, as Christian Barnard was in his first heart transplants, and others like him, Dr. DeBakey, of revolutionary pioneers. But they weren't creating new hearts. They were merely finding ways to replace the existing heart, which up to that point had not been done. So once you had a heart condition, you were told, you know, you either live with it or die with it. Now imagine something else. And this is going to be a more complicated issue, and I want you to take more time to share your insight on this. For about 20 years, we have had the resurgence of a new form of eugenics. And they're very clever about how they're going about it. Bill Gates is certainly one of the advocates in that put contraception into vaccines. Now, from his perspective and from the eugenics perspective, it makes a great deal of sense. Why? Because if you have 7.5 billion people and you're expected to add another billion people in the next several years, and you don't have the feed in those areas, the food to feed these people, nor the resources, and you have desertification and you have global warming, and you're going to have less water, less land, more starving, rather than see people suffer and die, especially children, why not just have contraception in place so that you won't have that? Now, of course, that's their logic. And from their mindset, it's perfect. Of course, if you said, well, why don't we practice birth control in people who are bankers and politicians and affluent groups? Why not have a eugenics program in Aspen, West Palm Beach, Palm Springs, Naples, Florida? They're going to say, what, are you crazy? So they're looking first to lessen the impact of those they consider undesirable. Then there's another position in this, and that is we have unruly children. We have delinquents. We have bullies. We have delinquents. We have people that make the rest of our lives dangerous. Why not create a science that allows us to take away some of the worst characteristics of human nature, rage and violence, and replace it with joy and cooperation? And then what we keep looking at everyone. And if you got the arm wrestling show, which is the newest reality show, it's all about giant guys who their whole life depends upon, can they wrestle down the arm of another person? And now it's bigger. We're like hyper-masculinizing everything, and then we hyper-masculinize violence. So it's not good enough now just to kill a zombie. You got to kill 300 zombies. And it's not just good enough, you know, to shoot someone, they fall over. You have to blow them, like in a Sam Peckinpah film, to smithereens. So everything has been hyper-violent, hyper-masculine, hyper-dominant. So what kind of man or woman, if you could choose to have the child of your desire, would it be a normal person of normal height? Would it be an extraordinarily well-endowed man or woman? Would it be taller and stronger and smarter? And what color hair and eyes? And what color quality skin? And then you start seeing where all this is going. Okay, so let's say they're able to achieve this, and I believe that they will be able to achieve much of this. What does that mean for everyone who is not that? Then suddenly you have two distinctly unique qualities within the human species, those that are dominant and preferable and those that are not. And no one talks about this. What do you do with the left behinds? Well, there would be about 98% of the American population and world population left behind, because you'd have new ones that are better at everything. And who wants the old when you've got the new? The old is aging and unreliable and emotional. And the new, well, they're obedient. They've been genetically programmed with this transhuman gene quality, so they can't really become rageful, and they don't need to be controlled, because they're already born at beginning to be controlled by the belief system they're part of. Do you see where I'm going with this, and do you see why I'm concerned about not just looking at replacing a gland or an organ or an eye or a heart, which is good, but they're really going for replacing the human population as we know it with one that gives them immortality and the control over a whole new human species? Your thoughts, please.
You brought up a couple of very interesting points, actually quite a few interesting points, Gary. One of them is the whole, you know, the point of this book is because we're extrapolating all of this knowledge into the future from what we already know in the past and what we know about the reaction of the elitists, how they would react, what they would do with the technology. Now, technology is an amazing thing. There's nothing wrong with technology. On the contrary, there are 7 billion people on the planet Earth. It's a small planet with natural, you know, limited natural resources. For us to get to the next plateau, which is 10 billion people, we need a lot of technological progress and development, because progress and development is directly proportional to population density. So if you have technology, we're going to get to the point where we're going to need a lot of it and very sophisticated technology to be able to support the life of 7, 8, 9, 10 billion people. So if you have the breakdown in this technological development, which is as we have right now on the one hand, we have, you know, deindustrialization, zero growth, demand destruction for us, as you said, for the 98% of the population. So they are sending us to hell in a handbasket on the one hand. But on the other hand, they're using, you know, the gazillions of dollars of their wealth to develop this incredible technology, not for the betterment of humanity, but for their own betterment, be it immortality. Obviously, that's one of the distinct possibilities with all those technological developments. But then again, we should also define what immortality means, because how you and I, or people, may understand immortality is certainly not how the elitists understand immortality, but I'll get to that in a second. You mentioned something very interesting. We're talking about, you know, the molecular redefinition and redesigning of us as people. You know, one of the biggest breakthroughs in recent history, scientists have created a synthetic genome that can self-replicate. You know, we're talking about nucleic acids, DNA, and RNA. Now, what they've done is, they've taken a cell and modified the genes of a cell by inserting DNA from another organism. Now, I know from, you know, from all the work you've done in the field in the last 30, 40 years, that you know quite a bit about this. Now, what they've done is that the bacteria replicated itself, thus creating a second generation of the synthetic DNA, which means that this organism will do exactly what the scientists intended to do. It's a living thing, but under the control of man. So if the 19th century was about the revolution of harnessing energy from fossil fuels, meaning oil, And the 20th century was about exploiting the power of data. This century is about controlling biology. And so, you know, with this new science called synthetic biology, mankind has literally, crossed the threshold. And the whole point of this is that we're coming into an age where one day, very, very, very soon, it'll be possible to design and manufacture a human being or a being. It doesn't even have to be human. Literally in a laboratory, beings that have never walked on the face of the earth. And again, this technology, if it's used for the betterment of humanity, can save lives. If you have diseases, they can be cured. But also, on the other hand, knowing again what we know about how the elitists work. Let me give an example. Take children, for example. Not only will parents have an opportunity to genetically select, or maybe I should say elect their children, building their characteristics block by building block, and in the process creating a new breed of children. No disease, high level of IQs, you know, physical characteristics as you wish them to be, you know, tall, short, you know, big hips or small hips, not to mention mixing other people's DNA in with a couple's to literally produce a new breed of humans. And this is being done as we speak in England right now. So the question is, if we give our children genes that we don't have, whose children are they? But there is an even darker side to this. For example, you know, parents who misbehave, or criminals, as you said, dissidents, people who think differently, you know, like you and I, from the official party line of one world state, we could have our children's DNA altered during pregnancy as punishment for our non-obedience. And what's more, if you alter the DNA, the private corporations and the governments who actually control the technology, they can create the society without memory. People whose life's experiences are stored in a memory drive running on a one-week cycle through modified DNA over and over and over again. And this is obviously something we definitely have to consider. As far as immortality is concerned, I think, again, their idea of what immortality means is very different of how we understand it. We may understand it as somebody, you know, who lives for a long time and then dies, or if it's immortal, as in that film Highlander, where somebody, you know, is 1,000 years old and looks a little, you know, rough around the ages, but for the most part still, you know, looks like a presentable 40 years old, although he's 1,000 years old. But for the transhumanist movement itself, the immortality is a very different concept. They don't care about their physical self. They don't care about their hair, about their skin color, about their blood. They care about cybernetic immortality, the idea of being able to upload your brain onto the computer and live forever in the machine. That's the capability that they're talking about. You know, so from cyborgs with very long lifespans to downloading consciousness itself into a machine. Again, you know, these people, the transhumanists, believe that they will be living this post-human existence, which according to them is far greater than anything we have right now. And another one of the areas of transhumanist dream is what they call hive mind, which refers to the giant collective intelligence that might be created when people all over the world link their brains together with technology. In other words, creating a whole new intelligence through symbiotic existence. It is this human beehive which has been the ideal society in the eyes of the elite for a very, very long time. And this is a template for post-humanity, the ultimate slave race, scientifically designed to never rebel, and the wholesale disappearance of the human being with his and her divine spark of reason at the expense of group speak, group think, and group action. And those who are saying that this hive mind sounds like some kind of a kooky concept, we already have it, except it's called cloud. And instead of uploading your files onto this universal collective cloud, we'll be able to upload our minds and using this technology literally, you know, to dominate the world as population, resource exploitation, and potential social conflict grows. Therefore, you know, the success of this convergent technologies priority area is essential to the future of humanity, and you will see how all of this will be pushed, you know, through the media, through Hollywood, you know, through science fiction films and books, and generally in the society, and they will make it part of the society itself over the next 2 years when the terminology itself, you know, will have been officially introduced, you know, into the society. People will have accepted it because we will have seen it already enough times, be it in films, in the media, you know, in the public discussions and forums, you know, television shows, etc., to accept it as part of future progress, I guess you would call it.
Before turning to the pros and cons of the transhumanist experiment, I feel it's important to address the movement known as Singularity, which was started by the person you mentioned earlier in the program, one of transhumanism's most popular gurus, Ray Kurzweil, the chief scientist at Google. And we see the ethics of Google when it cooperated with the government and the national security state to spy on us. So their ethic is zero, in my opinion. Singularity is immensely popular with many thousands of disciples throughout the IT world, particularly within the Silicon Valley corporations. And we know what kind of character these clowns have. And Kurzweil's vision is for an evolutionary future where machines will be human, even if they are not biological. He believes this is the height of human evolution, whereby human mortality is completely within our control. So tell us more about the Singularity movement. Who are its main leaders and important proponents, and how far has it succeeded in accomplishing its goals? And is there any evidence that Singularity's mission has won devotees and funders among the corporate and federal governments, such as the military intelligence and financial elite?
I think it's obvious that, needless to say, it's being supported at very, very high levels of government. Now, again, the Singularity would occur at the point in which artificial intelligence will surpass the capabilities of the human brain, when we don't really know. But what we do know is, because again, we don't know because we're dealing with the future and we're extrapolating our knowledge from the present and from the past into the future. So we can, you know, pretty much have a block modeling diagram. We just don't know exactly when it will happen. But what is absolutely true is that the Singularity movement and individuals such as Ray Kurzweil, Michio Kaku, Jason Silver, they're very, very closely associated with a movement called Russia 2045, whose, you know, ideological leader is this Russian by the name of Dmitry Itzkov. Now, basically what this is that the world scientific futurist community is convinced that, you know, by 2045, actually by 2035, mankind will come very close to understanding the principles of consciousness. They're convinced that in 20 years, the first successful attempt to transfer one's personality to an avatar will take place. And they call this period the epoch of cybernetic immortality. A new, you know, new dawn, the era of new humanity. And basically what the scientists want to do, and again, we're talking about some of the, you know, most brilliant minds in the history of mankind who are working together towards these projects. And again, it'll be false and wrong to consider all of these, you know, mad scientists and evil globalists, because a lot of them, I'd say most of them, are scientists who are primarily concerned about the betterment of science at the expense of anything else, and obviously for the betterment of humanity. Needless to say, you know, we can go back and look at the history of the atomic bomb, the idea behind it, and how it was actually used, and for what purposes, and very little to do with one another. But basically, what these scientists want to do is to incrementally move the human mind into more disembodied, and I guess no better way to say it, futuristic vehicles. And they have, you know, the step-by-step process, which will go from 2035 to 2045. First, a humanoid robot controlled entirely by a human brain via brain-machine interface. Then a conscious human brain transplanted into a humanoid robot. And then consciousness itself uploaded to a computer. And finally, a hologram that contains a full conscious human mind. Now, this may seem futuristic, but again, according to the mega project Russia 2045, they intend to create a new vector for civilization aimed at future human development and evolution by integrating new discoveries and development from science and physics, energetics, aeronautics, bioengineering, nanotechnology, neurology, cybernetics, and cognitive science. But yes, as you said earlier, you know, the scientific community is one thing, but the idea behind this kind of technology and how it will be used, militarily, are two very, very different things.
Before we go into another aspect, there's been some amazing and remarkable discoveries made in neurosciences and biotechnology, aside from their potential applications in the transhuman experiment. I've been involved in anti-aging medicine for most of my adult life. However, in my approach, it's always based upon what is natural and safe as an alternative principle that involve mind-body medicine and practices. And so I know that that's not what they're looking at. So also speak about this synthetic biology, this synthetic DNA called XNA. Tell us about the research in this area and what is being hoped to achieve through this research. And in your estimation, what have been some of the other positive contributions associated with transhumanism?
Let's start with neuroscience. There's actually a very interesting TV series on Fox called Almost Human, where one of the main characters is a cyborg cop. And those who haven't seen it and you're interested to understand how this transhumanist movement actually works and tries to convey their ideas through television, this is a great series to watch. Now, neuroscience, needless to say, is a very important area of transhumanist movement, and it's, of course, the study of the nervous system. Now, today, with the advances in chemistry, computer science, engineering, medicine, and also many other disciplines, neuroscience now also includes the study of the molecular, cellular, structural, developmental, functional, evolutionary, computational, and also medical aspects of the nervous system. So from molecular and cellular studies of individual nerve cells to imaging of sensory and motor tasks of the brain, neuroscience today has crossed the threshold of science and has become a key element of national security apparatus the world over. And so the development of sophisticated neural weapons will create a perpetual state of uncertainty with the promise and peril of the development of neural warfare and also its effects. Emotional detection systems will pervade public areas as global surveillance networks could seek out alleged terrorists and criminals. And as I said, you know, in my book, that these technologies, although they're hugely beneficial to humanity if used correctly, they're not being developed, you know, to help us, nor are they being developed to stop the terrorists, as Obama's and Bush's and everyone else is so fond of saying. These technologies are being developed to stop us, the people, and the laws to justify these technologies, they were not written, you know, on a whim. They're specifically designed to give every government on the planet complete authority over the people during the chaos and confusion of what they call the age of transition, a transition to a planetary civilization. And that's something we have to do everything in our power to make sure it doesn't happen. Now, something else you mentioned, if we're talking about the technology and itself. Synthetic genes, when we're talking about DNAs and in RNAs, they have been inserted into the bacterium, which has had its own original DNA stripped out. And collectively, these DNA RNA substitutes are called XNAs. Now, one of the notable properties of XNA molecules is they're not biodegradable. And the researchers also have developed enzymes that can synthesize XNA from the DNA templates, plus others that can reverse transcribe XNA back into DNA. This means they can store and copy data just as the DNA can. And this means that we're literally, you know, at the threshold, as I said earlier, of this greatest evolutionary change in the history of mankind. So you can literally, you know, get a DNA of anything on Earth and create organisms that never before existed entirely from non-living materials. And so scientists are creating new life forms, but at the same time, we're creating life forms that the human immune system and the world have never so far experienced. As such, it will revitalize perennial questions about the significance of life, what it is, why it is important, and what role humans should have in its future. And I don't have an answer to these questions, because again, one of the things about my new book, Transevolution, The Coming Age of Human Deconstruction, is because we're extrapolating all this knowledge into the future, when you get to the end of the book, you have a lot of questions that simply don't have answers. We need to wait to get at these answers in the near future.
Back in the 1950s, the political philosopher Hannah Arendt, in her book, The Human Condition, warned about the paradox of our age that is now coming upon us with biological and physical technology. She actually quoted the Nazi scientists brought to the United States under the CIA's Operation Paperclip, Wernher von Braun, who stated basic research is when, quote, I'm doing what I don't know what I'm doing. Now, this pretty well explains my view about the great deal of the dominant sciences today with vaccines and drugs, nanotechnology and geoengineering and GMOs and more. On the one hand, we're dividing this idea that as long as we do it, it is ethical because we're the official source of all truth, versus those who say, well, hold on a second, shouldn't you first determine, do we need this? Who should be responsible for it and how should it be used? So they're diving ahead, inventing new technologies and trying to push those technologies to market as quickly as possible, even if they don't have safety data. However, on the other hand, the actual research to determine the pros and cons of their potential impact on human life and the environment drags behind at a snail's pace. And Hannah then went on to say something I find rather amazing. This, by the way, was in 1958. What we're witnessing, she said, is the veritable art of making nature, that which is of creating natural processes without men would never exist, and which Earth by herself seems incapable of accomplishing. Now, these natural processes, she continues, have been exclusively sciences that are potentially irreversible. They are irredeemably of no return. So once you start doing something, no one's going to stop it. No one's going to reverse it. We see that now with GMOs. For the moment, we can think of GMOs as one scientific process which now is irreversible because GMO pollen is contaminating wild species of plants and animals, salmon, for example. And this is a permanent alteration unless there is some magical way discovered in the distant future to transfer back a genetically modified genome to its original non-GMO genetic code. And basically what we are witnessing is a conflict between biological evolution and technological processes. So would you speak on this relationship between biological evolution and the Promethean myth of technological progress?
Well, I think, as you were talking, I was thinking super soldier. You know, the rise of the machines is here, and we're facing the time when an unconscious evolution period is almost finished. And so we come to the new period when a controlled human evolution can and will happen, you know, whether we like it or not. And so technological progress will be concentrated on making a new body for the human being. And as I said earlier, the plan is to incrementally move the human mind into more disembodied and futuristic vehicles. First, a humanoid robot controlled entirely by a human brain, then a conscious human brain transplanted into a humanoid robot, and then consciousness itself uploaded to a computer, and finally a hologram that contains a full conscious human mind. And all of this is being done as we speak. DARPA, for example, you know, they're funding dozens of human augmentation projects around the world to radically improve the performance, mental capacity, and also resilience of their soldiers. Everything from tapping the potential of their unconscious minds to augmented cognition and the creation of uninhibited combat vehicles, whereby the military literally expects in a very near future, you know, individual pilots will fly in entire squadrons of robotic planes. And so the agency is working hard to establish also an array of cybernetic insects. DARPA, for example, is working on implanting computer chips in moths while still in a pupa stage for use in surveillance. And so, you know, the program seeks to fuse mechanical microtechnologies to living insects, creating a machine-bug amalgam. But, you know, you start with that, and you could easily, you know, progress to humans in the future. Think of that film way back when, The Fly. you can have the same in the very near future, but, you know, the real monster-like form. And all these technology and all these experiments also include, for example, outfitting other insects with minuscule sensors, cameras, wireless transmitters attached to the, you know, to the nervous system that they control remotely, and you'll be able, needless to say, to do the same thing with humans. No matter how we look at it, Gary, we're witnessing an unparalleled explosion in scientific knowledge. And if you kind of, you know, go back and look at what, you know, what we've achieved in the last half a century, because of the synergy, the interplay of three great revolutions, quantum, computer, and biotech revolutions, we have learned more in the last 50 years than in all of human history. And you know, the marvels of science like the internet, telecommunications, satellites, laser beams, radio, television, you know, structures of DNA molecules, biotechnology, and all of this ultimately comes from the quantum theory. And so, you know, we have the means through genetics, robotics, information technology, and nanotech to control matter and energy and life itself. We've never seen anything like this before. And again, it's raising profound questions about the very definition of being human. And then, of course, we come to areas such as augmented reality, which is the melting of the real world with the computer-generated imagery. And all of these technologies are being converged first on the battlefield and then, needless to say, you know, in real-life situations for the rest of the people.
The second part I'd like you to address is that when we look at the expectations of transhumanism, we're dealing with a vision that is founded more on a metaphysical belief, philosophical and aspirational, than pure science with respect to the goals it hopes to achieve. For example, this quest for technological immortality that you've been talking about through a bizarre marriage between cognitive science and nanotechnology and biotechnology and computerized artificial intelligence. And one of the unanswered questions that transhumanists cannot answer is that what is consciousness? And unless consciousness is purely mechanical, which I do not believe it is, in the biological sense of neuroelemental processes, their faith in a post-human future is closer to a religious belief than a scientific fact. So speak on the metaphysical dimension of transhumanism and what are the most critical ethical implications that transhumanism is likely ignoring that may likely bring disaster in the future?
That's a very, very good question. I don't know how to answer that question, you know, definitively, let's say, because I do believe that they think that, you know, you can literally take anything, even, you know, the very concept of our divine spark of reason and recreate it in a laboratory, maybe not today, but, you know, 20, 30 years from now. And Ray Kurzweil, for example, he talks about this, being able to, in about 25 years from now, by 2045, recreate the divine spark of reason, something which makes us uniquely human and unlike any other being out there in the universe. But, you know, if you kind of look at, you know, the idea that these people have about immortality and the future, brain-machine interfaces, for example, they would allow to control the machinery of the brain itself, implantable brain chips, be able to store information and enhance cognitive functions. These are the kinds of things, physical things you can create and implant, which is different from the divine spark of reason. And so for them, for the transhumanist movement, the ultimate human-machine symbiosis would be to download the actual copy of the person's brain onto a supercomputer the same way we can download organs right now, you know, using a 3D printer. And again, their vision of this nightmare future would allow someone to effectively live forever in a computer-generated virtual simulation. And of course, the military implications of a convergence are remarkable. You know, a cybernetic enhancement of human performance is absolutely inevitable. You know, there's no two ways about it. But achieving these visions requires the decoding and understanding of complex systems, and needless to say, the most complex system is the human brain itself. And again, the Ray Kurzweils of this world, they're convinced that we'll be able to decode the human brain by the year 2045 and then upload it into an avatar of our choosing. But the whole point of augmentations on a metaphysical level, it's a huge business for the corporations. You know, for years, we've been integrating ourselves with technology, replacing, for example, damaged limbs with mechanical limbs, you know, hearts with mechanical hearts, bionic eyes, and so on and so forth. But in the very near future, we'll be talking about implanting data chips into our bodies, which will give away huge amounts of information to governments and corporations all across the world. And so my question is, has it come to the point when we will be actively encouraged to exchange our perfectly functional body parts for upgraded applications? I'm convinced yes, because again, through media and through the power of Hollywood and through peer pressure and through social media, I think absolutely they'll be able to achieve that. But all of this ultimately comes at a price, because the people who are augment their bodies by implanting these chips, by changing their body parts, for mechanical body parts, they'll have to take drugs for the rest of their lives to make sure that the augmentations work. These drugs are both dangerous, they're addictive, and they're expensive. And what happens is, if people don't take the drugs, their bodies will reject the augmentations. And so the elitists will have their technology in us. They will have the power to turn off our limbs, the potential to turn off our eyes, send messages to our brain, and also control the very thought process as if they had the power of God. And, you know, if you look around us, this technology is there. Intel is working on sensors that will be implanted in the brain and will be able to directly control computers and cell phones. When? How about 5 years from now, by the year 2020? And needless to say, again, technology, if used for the betterment of humanity, is an incredible advancement, because the potential benefits are beyond imagination. I mean, everyone instantaneously could become, you know, the smartest, not just as smart as a Google search engine, because we'll be able to upload or download anything that's out there in the history of mankind in a matter of minutes or hours onto our brain the same way we do now onto an external disk drive. Okay, how about reading a 500-page book in 1/1,000,000th of 1 second? How about learning, you know, an English language or French or Italian or Spanish in, what, about 2.5 seconds? How about learning the entire history of mankind in a day? These are the possibilities, and they're endless, but so is the potential for abuse. Through interaction, for example, implantable microchips can talk directly to the brain, bypassing the sensory receptors, and this would give any tyrannical government an ultimate form of control. So if you could download thought and feelings directly into the brain of the citizens, you could achieve total control and never have to worry that they would turn on you, as we have seen in the Ukraine, as we're seeing in Venezuela, as we're seeing, you know, in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, in Russia in the 1990s, in Detroit, you know, with Occupy Wall Street movement, in Bangkok, Thailand, or anywhere else in the world where people simply get sick and tired of being abused and oppressed, and they rise up, you know, to actually go against a very small group of elitists, globalists, and super rich who control the levers of power.
Something as mundane as a bike race portends what you're suggesting. For more than 15 years, Lance Armstrong was the most famous cyclist in the world. He repeatedly stated he was doing it the old-fashioned way, through determination and perseverance and hard training. Now we know that not only did he drug constantly throughout this entire time, but everyone around him drugged. In fact, it's now come to the attention of the mass media that they would, one of the cyclists walked into a room where Armstrong and all of his teammates for the postal team were, and he was getting an IV drip. Now, this was an IV drip of vitamins. These were a combination of different drugs, and his own chemist, the man who concocted all this, said he didn't know what it would do, and it would either make him a winner or it would kill him. And he said this. He said he was experimenting. He didn't know. He had caffeine and ephedra and growth-stimulating hormones, testosterone, had everything in there. Now, and the doctor, all of them were part of it. But then when it was said, why did you do that? And he said it was this simple. Everyone in the world of cycling was doing it. And if you didn't do it, you could be guaranteed not to win. And if you won,
that's obvious.
If you won, you could earn, you know, tens of millions, in his case, hundreds of millions of dollars. So what he was saying, the entire field, and we found that out now, of leaders were on these drugs. I, as an athlete, I just competed and won a national, I won a gold in a national 20K championship just a week ago, Sunday. And yet the people that I was racing against, none of them were on any enhancing drugs. These are what are known as road bums, meaning they're all great athletes, some former Olympians, and they never get out of shape. All they do every day of their lives is train and then race, train and race. And they just go out there, they put in the miles, they do it the old-fashioned way, and it's always a pleasure and a privilege for me to race with them because I know how hard they work. But we also see, even in the Olympics, how many of them were banned and thrown out after they had medaled because they were caught drugging. So if we have a way of genetically enhancing someone who doesn't have to take a banned drug, but would have a genetically enhanced capacity at the mitochondria to create ATP, adenosine triphosphate, so they could run faster, jump further. That's going to give them an enormous advantage. And all we care about today in our society is winning. The power and celebrity and prestige that comes from winning dwarfs everything else. And if you're not a winner, you're automatically a loser. In our society, we only have winners and no one else. So imagine then taking that same mindset into a whole form controlled by psychopaths and sociopaths, our leaders, in all fields, education, religion, government, science, business, it doesn't matter. And now, look at the implications for a society that is inherently selfish. They deny their culpability. They want their reward and take it upon themselves when they win. They want to blame someone else when they lose or are caught. Your thought when it comes then to looking at where is the moral balance in making decisions that could not just affect those who want that extra gain in life, but the consequences to everyone else because of it. Final question.
I think we are way past moral society. I think it's at a point where, you know, speaking of technology, you could take a chip, you could potentially program any chip to make any citizen feel good all the time or become a winner all the time. You know, this, again, will be the ultimate goal of Huxley's scientific dictatorship without tears. Soma personified. The future is now. So instead of drugs like cocaine or marijuana or amphetamines or drugs that will actually give performance-enhancing drugs, you know, giving you a high or shooting you to the moon, you can have these chips produce a natural high that never ends, or a high that allow you to win, you know, and drug dependency replaced by fully government-sanctioned chip dependency. And I think this is the way of the future.
I don't see that all of us are going to benefit from this, even if it were all good. I only see, as in our society today, look at the disparity between those who have and have not. The top percent of people, which is the 100th of 1%, gained $4 trillion in the last year, just a small group of people. You continue to see an excessive concentration of power and resources and wealth, and with that, policy making in the hands of fewer people. What does this mean for the entire field of trans evolution?
I don't know. I've thought about it in the past. But I don't know how to answer that because, again, one of the things about the book is that we're extending this, extrapolating into the future. I think there's a lot of unknowns there which these people take for granted, and I think we'll be unpleasantly surprised when we actually come up against it, how it will affect the development of the entire transhumanist industry. I don't know. But I do know that we, the people, the 99%, have a lot to say in this. And for us to actually, you know, form a part and be counted, we have to understand exactly the reason why we're here on the planet Earth. What is our role in achieving this, you know, elusive immortality that I mentioned earlier? And how understand our place in the universe, which are all very, very important concepts that unfortunately very few people have ever thought about.
Let me give you a final overthought and see your insight on this, all right? You've done a brilliant expose today of laying out what is possible. the trouble is we do not live in a transparent society of equality. We talk about a democracy, but we're in fact a republic. We're supposed to have fair representation, and yet those in power buy excessive representation disproportionate to their number. As a result, everything now is skewed against the independent thinking person that wants fairness in all things. In fact, we now, the activists, whether you're active against, for example, showing animal cruelty, now another state, the governor of Utah, just signed a law that could put you in jail for years and $1,000 fine if you actually expose animal cruelty, which was done just a few weeks ago when it showed farm workers stomping and beating little tiny cows and even sexually abusing animals. Those people were not the ones punished. But if you expose the crime, you're punished. Now we know that the people that we mentioned earlier, the Occupy people, they're the ones who are now looked upon as terrorists because they're agitators. Anyone today in the United States that challenges the status quo of any corporate group or governmental agency or individual that has power will be targeted. And the mechanism for targeting is the national security state. And it's vast, over 16 different agencies with an unlimited budget and millions of people working within the system who have top security clearance. They have been looking at every one of our emails. Now they want to know what we're thinking and why we make the choices we do. They want to know about your porn choices. And why would they want to know that? What businesses are theirs, them? Because they want to know how to control people. They want to know which individuals most likely will be the ones you talk about that could challenge the status quo, that could challenge the excesses and the lack of legitimacy in something. So here we stand. We stand at a perfect storm. Our health is failing. Our environment is in chaos theory. We're compounding natural disasters. Over 125,000 extreme weather events occurred in just the last 12 months. We're having the worst of everything happen now, and it's only going to get worse because we're not changing any of the underlying causes. And yet we're also punishing anyone who chooses to make any positive changes. If you want to improve the environment, you're a terrorist. You want to clean up the food supply, you're a terrorist. You want to protest against gas hydrofracking, its overuse of water from natural resources, the pollution of the environment or human health, you're a terrorist. You want to close down nuclear power plants because they're inefficient and dangerous and pose a threat, you're a terrorist. You want to vote for an independent party person? Well, you're just a nut job. Jill Stein, Ralph Nader, Dennis Kucinich, Ron Paul, Gary Johnson. Why would you vote for those people? They don't have any chance of winning, says the good corporate Democrat, the people who voted for Obama and Clinton and would vote for Clinton next time as well, Hillary Clinton. So when you look around at a nation that's obese, a nation that is despondent, a nation that is that is descended into emotional anarchy and depression, the nation that just wants to be held into a positive entertainment state, that is the perfect audience for someone who would sign up immediately if they could be put into an altered state so they don't have to worry about their bills, their future, who to vote for. Everything would be programmed into them. I believe that we're at a time when the vast amount of Americans would embrace any new technologies, especially those that would warrant that they wouldn't have to suffer and could be kind of in a euphoric state. And there would be a tiny, tiny 1% fraction left over. And I believe those people would be summarily dismissed as irrelevant to any discussion. Final quick answer, please.
Absolutely. You know, once upon a time, spies, you're talking about, you know, control, had to place a bug in your chandelier to hear your conversations, or they rummaged through your garbage to see what was in there. And today, needless to say, with today's technology, you don't need to do this. You know, Google Earth, they provide, you know, entire movements, you know, using cell phone conversations, which is, you know, obviously used remotely activated for espionage purposes. Radios can reveal which frequency is being listened to. Human beings emit radio waves in the ELF spectrum. And so, you know, the security services, they don't need to place a bug on us to track us down. They know all this information. It's being leaked into our environment 24/7 by our own bodies. All it takes is the right equipment to convert these signals into intelligence. And I think basically people, to a greater extent, have given up and are prepared to accept any kind of a state whatever it is, as long as they're left alone and the government lets them be and let them live their miserable little lives as they're living them right now.
Well, that's where we're at. But you bring us an insight and you bring us a truth. I just don't know that we're willing to understand and embrace your truth, but it sure is needed. Thank you very much, Daniel Estulin, ESTULIN.com. The book is Trans Evolution. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.